Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 115 of Wheat All About It, or what I've entitled Falling Numbers Past, Falling Numbers Future, Time Travel with OSU's Andrew Ross, about Ross's presentation at the Falling Numbers Summit, as well as an interview he did with me at its conclusion. Andrew Ross is Oregon's wheat quality guy, for want of a more appropriate title, like the one Oregon State University bestows, a simple professor, with an interest in fundamental and applied research of cereal grain components and wheat and barley-based foods. An Australian, Ross has been associated with Falling Numbers issues for 34 years. I say again, 34 years. He has a photo to prove his early years in the Falling Number trenches, working to create a device that could gauge alpha amylase content in samples faster for a lower cost. The research succeeded with the development of the Rapid Visco Analyzer, or RVA. Alas, it could not dislodge Falling Numbers, which, as Ross put it, has become a term of trade and apparently an immovable edifice. Ross is an entertaining speaker, even to those like me who don't understand everything he says. I've got a clip ahead of Ross in full science speak, which I'll admit is even more difficult to comprehend without context. I share it not to expose my own ignorance, but as an example of how specialists working together to solve a problem sometimes create a language of their own.
So the things that have been done measure the alpha-amylase activity directly, so artificial substrates or chromophores, so megazyme or dilinked starches like fatabase, release of reducing sugars, so the GOPOD, glucose oxidase, peroxidase, linked assay, blood glucose meters and things like that, the release of a chromophore. They've used the reduction in turbidity of a turbid beta limit dextrin, which was impossible to make, and the Canadians were really upset that we didn't take their test on, but the substrate was so horrible. We can measure the actual abundance of protein in terms of like immunological or tests, visual observation, use adjuncts to observe the visual modification, fluorescein dibutyrate, or X-rays or other spectral techniques.
Luckily, Ross knows his audience, and while he can dive as deep as any, he understands communication is perhaps the most important ingredient in fostering progress toward a goal. He loves being part of a team and believes teams are the greatest way of moving forward, because as he put it, you can't be an expert at everything. He is not, however, optimistic that there is a solution to low falling numbers caused by late maturity alpha amylase, which is caused by a cold shock in the late spring. He does, however, believe that researchers will find a way to manage the phenomenon. Part of the reason for his optimism is the eruption of computing power that can be brought to bear on the problem. As part of his presentation, he talked about using an Apple IIe with 256K of memory to log results in 1986. Nowadays, memory is measured in gigabytes, which are factors of thousands of times larger. That and teaching machines to learn about falling numbers will have a huge impact on the development of management strategies. In addition to looking forward, Ross is something of a repository for the world's knowledge on how falling numbers came to be. I think it's important to know history so we aren't always reinventing the wheel. I also want you, my listeners, to understand that the story of falling numbers is a long one. Ross was 3 years old in 1960 when Sven Hagberg and his co-worker, Harold Purton, both at the cereal laboratory of the Swedish Institute for the Crafts and Industries, came up with the idea for the falling number test that bears their name.
So this is the original paper. This is a rapid method for determining alpha amylase activity by Sven Hagberg, published in March 1960. It was actually submitted to Cereal Chemistry in 1958, and it took it till 1960 to be published. But I think they were doing everything by snail mail, so it's not like these days. But and so I was born in 1957, so this is kind of to give you a sense of that the falling number is getting bald and grey and should be, you know, put out to pasture. And then we get down to May 1964, which is the paper that most of us think about if we think about the history of Falling Number, which is the original Harold Purton one. But this is important in, you know, we're not any smarter than those people were. We just have better tools, I think, is really a place where we're at in the modern world.
While the risk to farmers from discounts was talked about earlier, Ross wanted attendees to understand that there was risk on the other end, the baking end. And risk is what the Falling Numbers test is meant to control for.
And where we heard about risk to farmers and discounts, but also what I mentioned before is the risk aversion of the buyers, and particularly of the processors. You know, we heard about the financial difficulties of growers getting discounts, but also the example I used of having a loaf of bread jam in the slices in a 10,000 unit an hour bread line. That's an economic hardship that those processors are not willing to risk. And so, when most of us are familiar with the alpha amylase Falling Number curve, it's a Power-Law curve, I think, and below 300 seconds, as the Falling Number gets to below 300 seconds, you start to have the risk of having more alpha amylase than you need. And so above 300 seconds, there's almost no risk of having excess alpha amylase. And it's a control, it's bakers being control freaks. They add alpha amylase, either as fungal amylase or as malt flour, to the flour, but they want it under controlled circumstances. And so I think it's risk aversion. It's that above 300 seconds, you have almost no risk.
When it comes to a replacement for the Falling Numbers test, Ross doesn't make it sound like building a better mousetrap will help. And yet, how can it not?
So by the time I get involved in this, it's 1984. It was. And by then, so the test is now 20 years old from the 1964 paper. And it was entrenched. It was in the grain chain, either as a lab test or in some cases as a field test. The AWB, as it was at the time, was starting to deploy it as a sort of like flying squad in the old sort of British cops way of, you know, they'd send a squad flying off to some problem where there was rain in the area. So they only had a limited number of Falling Number machines, but if they looked like there was rain in the area, they would deploy them in the field. And but before that, if you look at closely at the Hagberg and Purton papers, sprouting, as like measuring sprouting, is kind of a secondary goal for them. What the primary goal was to help flour millers correct for alpha amylase in their flour. And so I think one of the reasons it's become entrenched is because flour millers like it. And on flour, it's much more precise than it is on wheat meal. Well, it's more precise. I don't know if much is right. Part of it, the inertia of getting rid of it is that the industry speaks Falling Number. It speaks Farinograph. The breeding community speaks Mixograph. You know, we're having conniptions right now because national manufacturing is folding. What are we going to do? You know, well, I'd think that maybe an 80-year-old instrument, we could probably do better than the Mixograph.
Those involved with the Falling Number Challenge have seen LMA samples measured as low as 250 seconds, a full 50 seconds below the standard that makes excellent loaves of bread. That's not the question, Ross argues. Just as people are different, so are bakeries. And those that pay more attention to detail, such as with their bread slicers, are able to operate closer to the edge.
And one bakery could cope with Falling Number in the flour down to 160 seconds, and one bakery couldn't cope with 270. And it ended up being how well they maintained their slices. Because the poorer maintenance of the slices, they weren't as sharp. The dextrins that are formed as part of the alpha amylase degradation of the starch would stick to the slices, and at some point a loaf would jam. You have them on a tunnel oven. You can't stop the tunnel oven. It's a world of hurt. So, you know, it is a real problem. And I would argue, despite what's come out of Australia more recently, that LMA amylase, even though it may be less aggressive, is still an enzyme of liquefaction, and that there is possibility that in some
plants, because remember, this was a standard loaf of bread. And so that flour mill, and this goes back to the 300 seconds, had to mill to the sensitivity of its most sensitive customer.
There's a lot of things to be upset over with regard to the falling number challenge, but I hadn't realized that poor knife maintenance was one of them. Now, the podcast segues into an interview I did with Ross after the Falling Numbers Summit's second day. It's January 30th, 2019, and we're sitting at a table in his hotel room at the Red Lion Hotel on Janssen Beach in Portland. I ask him how he got involved with Falling Numbers all those years ago.
It was my first job out of college. My college degree is in agricultural sciences, and I majored in ag chemistry. And my work in ag chemistry was looking at carbohydrate-modifying enzymes in root nodules. And so amylase is a carbohydrate-modifying enzyme, so that was where the link came in. So my first job was literally stepped into the project that created the rapid visco analyzer when it was very specifically to deal with improving the measurement of pre-harvest sprout at delivery of the grain.
Has Australia solved the problem? They've been working on it much longer than we have in the States.
I can't answer that too thoroughly because I haven't lived in Australia for 20 years. But I would say that the problem isn't solved. The problem may be managed by deployment of objective instruments rather than visual assessment of sprout. But I still think there's a challenge in breeding for durable pre-harvest sprout resistance.
Now you're talking about pre-harvest sprout. I mean, and I guess my interest is on late maturity alpha amylase. We've been dealing with pre-harvest sprout, ever since I've been involved in the industry for 30 years. Sometimes it rains at harvest. We deal with it. We go on. But LMA is like a new animal has come into the landscape. Am I missing something here?
I think that the negative economic impact of pre-harvest sprout does warrant some examination or continued examination of ways that we can better manage it and ways that we could maybe breed to minimize the eventuality that we get when we do get rain around harvest. The LMA one is not, from my point of view at least, new, because I know that in Australia people have been working on that for about 30 years. And I think what's maybe more new about it and I think for me puzzling is that LMA has an impact on the test, the falling number test, in that it liquefies the starch enough to give a low reading on the falling number test, and hence it crosses over with pre-harvest sprouting, which also does the same. Because we can't distinguish them in the grain chain, then because of the low falling number alone, it's precluded from being, sold as milling grade wheat. The more recent data that's coming out of multiple research groups that suggests that despite its ability to liquefy starch in the falling number test, that it's not as impactful in terms of liquefying starch during product manufacture.
But it still has the same discount as pre-harvest sprout.
Well, but that's the thing. That's the focus of what I was just trying to say. There is that we see that it reduces falling number, and we're building some evidence that it doesn't have an impact on product quality. So consequently, maybe not as profound an impact on product quality. So we really need to do the foundational work to say, if it's LMA, then the grain is perfectly reasonable to put that into the marketing stream. But we need to have a rock solid way of distinguishing those when the grain's delivered. That if there's a low falling number event a test that the elevator or wherever it is can apply another test the new test that's developed immediately distinguishes them on delivery of the grain. But I think the jury's out as to just whether or not that LMA-affected grain still should be discounted because it may cause problems in processing. And I really don't think there's enough information. Now, I'm really, really itching to get my hands on like kilogram or 10 kilogram or 20 kilogram size samples of LMA-affected wheat with the controls that are of the same variety that are not affected, so I can do fairly big product runs, you know, because products ain't products. You know, different products have different susceptibilities to enzymatic activity, the amount of water that's in them, the size of the product, its dimensions, whether it's thin and narrow or whether it's round, you know, steam buns versus noodles versus standard breads, they all have slightly different time temperature profiles, which are really important in understanding how enzymes affect those systems.
This was the second Falling Numbers Summit. The first was held in Spokane. Have we made any progress between these two summits?
What I see from today's today and yesterday's presentations are the foundations of progress. That, you know, we see the machine learning guy is doing his algorithms and creating his artificial intelligence, which I think could eventually be used with multiple data inputs that would then allow us, rather than just measuring amylase or just measuring starch susceptibility or just measuring some plunger falling through a boiling tube of, you know, cream of wheat, that we could take those different signals and that machine learning would give us a much, much greater capacity to decide is it deliverable, should it be discounted, which type of amylase is it. So the thing are the foundational blocks of that are an improvement on the immunological side. You know, since the original antibody test was created for wheat, which was actually in the same labs I was working in Sydney at the time, the advances in immunological research tools, you know, probably mirror the advances in computing power and machine learning and ability to handle big data. I see it, and you asked me the question yesterday, are we reinventing the wheel? I think to a certain extent when I was working on this in the 80s that it was a reinvention of the wheel. But I think right now the wheel is invented and what we're doing is making that wheel much, much better because we just have such amazingly new, like revolutionary tools at our disposal that we didn't have in the 1980s. And so I do think that I think there's progress on the side that's management side. We're looking at measuring and monitoring and making decisions during grain trading and also in the thinking of the breeding programs, how to deal with it from the point of view of both LMA, and I still argue that pre-harvest sprouting could do with some reduction. You know, it's not unhelpful. And because we're dealing with variations on the same type of enzyme base, you can probably run both of those in parallel without really stretching the resources.
There were several Falling Number events before 2011, but 2011 was a significant one, and it was at that point that the Washington Grain Commission decided to start putting money into investigating the LMA phenomenon as different from PHS. I got to tell you, I was quite impressed by the number of people that were at this conference. How have we done in terms of the progress of putting together a team to investigate this phenomenon?
The last 2 days have been quite interesting in looking at that, particularly looking at the younger scientists and the graduate students. The thing that going back to an earlier question about, you know, or a comment at least one of us made about reinventing the wheels, is we have fresh eyes on this problem. I mean, we may still have the same fundamental problem or problems, but new eyes. Now, sometimes I look at them from my, you know, jaundiced position as the old guy in the room as being naive about some of the issues, but then it's my job as part of the team to say, you're being naive about this part of the issue, you may want to take it into consideration. And so that new energy, the new perspectives, I think is actually incredibly important about moving things forward, because I think what we need to do to move things forward in a profound way is to have a change of thinking. And I do believe for myself that I've been doing it for so long, and I have such, I guess, not rigid views, but views that are well supported by evidence, but I find it hard to break out of that perspective. And I believe that one of the values that we have here is the energy of young scientists and the dedication of the young scientists. And obviously we've got a lot of senior scientists around, and both on the breeding and genetic sides and on the quality side, who are there to give mentorship and guidance. So I'm really quite thrilled with it. I think it's a great outcome in terms of building an edifice that can at least move forward, and I'd find it not necessarily maybe solve the problem, but manage the problem.
Is there an outcome that farmers can look forward to in the next few years with regard to this whole issue?
I hope so. The reason I say it that way is because this is actually a pretty good example of a scientific investigation. We don't know what the answer is going to be. Now, obviously we have goals and objectives, but in embracing scientific research as something to help move us forward, and it's applied research, and we have a goal to make things better, but sometimes the answer is not what you want. It's not like we're absent outcomes right now. The holy grail of those outcomes would be a rapid, relatively inexpensive, precise test that told you that the grain was suitable for further processing or not. And that if it was not suitable for further processing, it was because of amylases and cellulases and proteases that came from pre-harvest sprouting. But that if it was amylases that came from LMA, it may well be. And I very deliberately didn't say anything in that sentence about falling number.
Mm-hmm.
Falling number, for me, it has some issues, I'd say, but it's not the problem. The idea of the falling number problem, the problem is that we have buyers who want to buy grain that's irrevocably sound, that it's clean, bright, free of fungi, free of mouse poop, free of sticks and weeds and brokens and all of the grading factors that make it US number one or US number two. And they also want to be sure that it's not pre-germinated. Or if LMA proves to be a processing issue, that it doesn't have LMA. I mean, if LMA doesn't prove to be a processing issue and we can differentiate it in the marketing stream, then, that's... But it's not about falling number. It's about what happens in the cookie plant or the bread factory, whatever other cereal processing facility.
Well, and certainly that's your priority. But, I'm coming from the point of view of the farmer who is looking at that discount. I mean, a 50-cent discount if he's at 250, which you and others have said is still okay grain.
Hang on. At 250 in the a grain falling number, if I was a buyer, no. The risk of bringing in excessive amounts of alpha amylase is really starting to get quite high. But in individual circumstances, we know that people will accept grain at 250, and they have ways of dealing with it in their process. But it's not... If I have to take any sort of ameliorating action in my factory, it costs me either labor or time or ingredients or all of those to overcome potential difficulties with the raw material. So I'm not going to pay, and I'm being pretty blunt here about being a buyer and a processor of the wheat, that I'm not going to assume that risk on top price grain. If I have if I consider the grain to be risky and I have to take steps to ensure that I don't have a failure in the plant, then, you know, I can see why there might be a discount. I understand the position of the farmers. I mean, I'm not unsympathetic to it. It's the same. It is, and you know, when I first started doing this, so in 1986, I remember being out collecting sprouted samples from trucks coming in delivering grain in the field in southern New South Wales, and seeing low falling number tests come out, and having seen grown men weeping in the cab of the truck, not able to drive home because they were so devastated because farming is running on narrow margins, and it didn't take much to go from profitable to losing the farm.
Ultimately, that's what's at stake, folks, losing the farm. In the last three podcasts, episode 113, 114, and this, 115, you've heard how the Northwest wheat industry has rolled up its sleeves to attack the falling number challenge using science and technology that wasn't available just a few years ago. After listening, I hope you understand better how universities, the government, farmers, and Wheat and Grain Commission members and staff have been working cooperatively to solve a growing problem with a long history. For those of you who might be new to the podcast, there's a lot more where this one came from, although podcast apps like iTunes or Stitcher hold a limited number of episodes. You can find all 114 previous episodes at the Washington Grain Commission website at WAGRAINS, that's WAGRAINS.org. Click on summaries and navigate back into time. I hope you enjoyed episode 115 entitled Falling Numbers Past, Falling Numbers Future, Time Travel with OSU's Andrew Ross. This was the third in my series of podcasts from the second Falling Numbers Summit held in Portland, January 29th and 30th, 2019. If you like this podcast, please share it with a friend and show said friend how to access future podcasts. Subscribe, and then join me here again next week for a new episode of Wheat All About It.
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat. But there's only one dilemma when there's not enough wheat. We feed you.